Good evening, everyone. The topic for this evening is religious change all around Europe. If in the past weeks our attention has been focused on Germany, then tonight we're going to look at other communities in Central, Western, and even Eastern Europe to see whether the spirit of reform affected those communities and how. Because sometimes what emerged as a non-traditional or non-orthodox style of Judaism in other parts of Europe was different from, qualitatively different from, that which appeared in Germany, whether in its practical changes or even in its nature of thinking, the theology about Judaism. Okay, so the first character we have to examine is that of Isaac Noah Mannheimer. Mannheimer came from Copenhagen, and Danish Jewry was a small community. And in 1817, they instituted a decorous and non-traditional type of worship service under Mannheimer, who at that time was 24 years old, a young preacher of limited Jewish education, rabbinic education. He's not a rabbi, he's a preacher. And he's conducting worship services, not in the main synagogue, but as a supplement to the services in the main synagogue. He's a local product. But he doesn't want to stay in his hometown because it's a dry. It's 1817. It's a dry bones community. What is a dry bones community? Not like the comic strip in the Jerusalem Post, but there's no life. There's no religious vitality to Copenhagen. He has broader horizons, and so he goes to check out Jewish communal life in Hamburg and in Berlin, the two places where in the late teens there were reform temples. And he's impressed by what he sees, the innovation of these houses of worship. And he would like to conduct those kind of services wherever he's going to land and have his career. Well, he was invited in 1821 to Vienna, the capital of the Habsburg monarchy. Vienna was a small Jewish community. It only had a group of tolerated Jews, in the sense that if you were a Jew who lived there, it wasn't simply that you could walk on in and say, I want to live here, but rather you had specific permission by the authorities for your family to live in that town. Very limited right of entry for Jews in the Habsburg capital at this time. There was no official rabbi. There was a religious functionary who was a kosher watcher, basically a mashgiach, to supervise the existence of kosher meat. But no rabbi, not even a preacher. There was the first permission given for the Jews of Vienna to build a building to serve as their house of worship, an actual synagogue building, was in 1811. It's pretty late in the game. By that point, plenty of other European, Central European cities have large Jewish communities with big institutions.
How big was the Jewish community in Denmark at that point?
In Denmark, at that time, only about 2,000 people. So, in 1820, Emperor Francis issues an edict that all religious services, Jewish worship services included, must move in the direction of vernacular services. Now, it can't happen overnight. There's no expectation it's going to happen overnight. But this was a coercive decree away from the Hebrew liturgy. However, the state authorities quickly reversed course and said, no, don't have vernacular liturgy, don't have vernacular services. Why? Because we're afraid that Judaism might become too attractive. Better, it should stay the old style that nobody likes as a way of bolstering the chances for conversion to Christianity, to Catholicism. Okay. The attempt... No, the government doesn't act in a very transparent way. It just issues a decree, but the decree was rescinded very quickly, and in examining the scholarly analysis of what they were trying to accomplish, we assume that they decided against German language Jewish services because of that reason.
Was there any advocacy group within the Jewish community that was pushing
Okay, so there's an advocacy group in favor of a move away from tradition, and it was believed by the government that this was a plaything of the nouveau riche, that the recently arrived and new money Jews wanted to have non-traditional services because they were moving away from religion. And the government decided it's not in the interest of catering to these people. Okay.
But wasn't the mass also not in your vernacular?
Right, which is going to explain why in Vienna, and later in, also we're going to discuss in France, there wasn't much of a move in the direction of vernacular prayer, but rather the maintenance of Hebrew. Okay, so a new synagogue building had to be built in the early 1820s. Why? What's the reason that always happens?
We don't happen then.
No. They needed to build a new building.
Oh. Fire?
So always, either the old one burned down, yeah, or the old one was declared unsafe. It was condemned because it was a hovel from a bygone period. So the shul in Vienna was declared unsafe. They had to build a new building. In April 1826, the new sanctuary is dedicated. And who are the clergy? Isaac Noah Mannheimer is the preacher, and Solomon Sulzer is the chazan and choir director. For those of you who know a little chazanus, Sulzer is one of the heavyweights of 19th century Central European chazanut, Tim and Lewandowski from Berlin. And we still sing plenty of their pieces to this day.
They were composers.
Okay, so in this synagogue of Vienna, there was no need for the Jew to bend over backwards to deny their Jewish national identity, or for that matter, to erase Zion from the prayers. Why not? Because the Habsburg Empire is a multinational empire where all the various constituent groups are free to express themselves and their ethnicity and their mores in their own way. So long as they don't break the law, and they basically are well-behaved citizens, it's okay to have ethnic flavor to your existence. You don't need to try to blend in and acculturate completely. So the Jew is fine to be a national Jew, so long as they accept citizenship and play by the rules. And so the prayers for Zion are not seen as somehow unpatriotic or subversive. Okay. Moreover, in a Catholic country, religious change is never viewed upon favorably, but rather the maintaining of old traditions is seen as a virtue. Also, pomp and ceremony are important. Theological conviction, not nearly as much. So if a new house of worship in Vienna looks like a cathedral, has the music, the beautiful music of a cathedral, the architecture of a cathedral, the preacher with the canonicals up in front, speaking in German as though this were a cathedral, so it's a Jewish cathedral. And that's enough. You don't have to change the prayer service and make it less traditional, move it away from Hebrew or the Nusach HaTfilah. That's not a concern. The Germans worried about theology and about Shivat Zion and Korbanot and those sorts of things, but in Vienna they didn't worry about that stuff. As long as it looked good and was decorous and impressive looking, fine.
Vienna was Catholic?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Sure.
It wasn't Lutheran?
No. Vienna was definitely Catholic.
Well, okay. Hitler was from Vienna. He was Hitler was from Vienna. Oh. He was Catholic.
Okay. So, more about form, less about content. Now, Mannheimer himself, as I said before, he was not a doctrinally orthodox guy or even orthoprax guy. He was willing to tinker in reform, and he looked upon the Berlin and Hamburg temples as a source of inspiration. However, he came to a quick realization that reform gets old really quickly. What is exciting because it is innovative, a month from now, a year from now, 5 years from now, is no longer new, is no longer exciting. It's just a reform, and other than what was for 1,000 years. So if you try to always have innovative reform, you're going to have to move further and further away from tradition. Ve'ein la davar sof. There's no end to the matter. So at some point you have to decide, sof, there's an end to the matter. We're going to do this. A few things are not the same as they were the previous generation. Certain things may be contrary to what our ancestors thought was appropriate. But this is what we're going to do, and we're going to stick to it. So this is the creation of the Minhag Vienna, the Vienna Rite, which was close to the traditional prayer service with limited changes. Basically, Mannheimer's style of Judaism bordered upon that of Zacharia Frankel and positive historical Judaism, except that whereas for Frankel, this was a theological idea and a sophisticated concept of positive historical Judaism, for Mannheimer, it just worked itself out that way. And this is what they came up with.
The Kehillah?
So, we're going to see that as the decades moved along, more Jews came to Vienna from eastern parts of the Habsburg Empire, namely the core of the Hungarian lands and Galicia. And they were very frum. And the presence of very frum people coming to Vienna from points east was a bulwark against further change away from tradition. Because if the indigenous Viennese Jews wanted to do further tinkering with the service to make it less frum, well, then the new arrivals would declare it to be totally treif and they'd want to have nothing to do with it, and you'd have communal disunity. And that's not what's something they wanted. So the modernizing faction within Vienna was held back from acting the way they might have wanted to by the recent arrival of more traditional Jews. Okay. That's already by the 1850s, 1860s.
Because I think a similar phenomenon occurred right after World War I, where the Jews from Poland came into Vienna.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
Big numbers.
Yes, yes. Even Hasidim did.
Yeah.
And you have in Vienna, there's a big community of Hasidim. Okay. So, what was the nature of Mannheimer's service? Reduced piyutim, confirmation service for bar mitzvah age children. No kol nidre. A lot of people got rid of kol nidre. It's not the biggest avera. Even a Shimshon Rafael Hirsch got rid of kol nidre. So, no organ. No organ.
Wow.
Very important. Why did Mannheimer oppose the organ? He felt that it is too closely associated with another religion. Simple as that. It's too churchy. Too churchy. And even though his synagogue was in many ways very churchy, the organ is too far. A step too far. He worked very long and hard on his sermons, drawing on the Midrash and on the Mefarshim to derive contemporary lessons, and he was regarded as a very good very good sermonizer. But primarily he was a pastor. He said by his own admission, I'm not a rav, I'm not a rabbi, I'm a pastor. So he cared about his flock. They had a real clergy person who worried about their spiritual needs and their life cycle occasions. He was very good at it.
Paskin Shilas.
Either they didn't have too many shilas, or later on they'd be a Beis Din. They would be a Beis Din later on.
So it seems the pastor had more power than the rav.
There was no rav.
But
no
you rav. Said the rav. You said I'm not a rav.
I'm not a rav. That doesn't mean I'm not the rav. There is no rav. Okay. I'm not a rav. I'm a pastor. Okay. Later they would hire real rabbis. Okay. Mannheimer was a fighter for social justice. But unlike in the 20th and 21st century variety of social justice, which usually means promoting things that are contrary to Jewish national interests, the 19th century version of social justice was in fact promoting Jewish interests, because the Jews are the beleaguered people, and he's fighting for their own rights, including the revolutions of 1848. And he was elected to the legislature in 1849. He fought for the elimination of the Jews tax. He was an all-around good character. He even got along with Chaim Sofer. How far is Vienna from Pressburg?
1 hour.
Not very far at all. It's very close by. Okay? So there was interaction between the preacher of Vienna and the Rav of Pressburg, the Rosh Yeshiva, the Gedolei Dor of Pressburg. Mannheimer got there in the early 1820s, and Chaim Sofer died in 1839. So for almost two full decades, they were an hour's train ride, or not train, but buggy ride away from each other, and there was reasonable relations between the two, despite the fact that Chaim Sofer has this reputation historically as having been a firebrand against reform, and Mannheimer was really a moderate reformer. They got along. Okay. Chaim Sofer never castigated Mannheimer as being a apikoris or a amoritz or a buffoon. It never said a bad thing about him.
Maybe he said it because he saw his clientele. You know, he was in Vienna.
Okay.
Did they know each other? Did they actually interact?
I don't know if they met in face to face, but they had correspondence, and there was writing about each other in the, that we know of. Okay, so.
So they respected each other.
Yeah, yeah. In the in 1848, the revolution failed, and there was a conservative reaction. So that in the 1850s, it was a time of. It was not a time conducive for the liberalizing of religion. And also, as I mentioned, Jews from eastern parts of the empire came to Vienna, and they had a certain mindset about Judaism. They were not interested in dramatic reforms. So those who wanted significant reforms in the community pressed the issue, and they wanted to hire another member to the clergy staff. Who did they hire? Adolf Jelinek. Adolf Jelinek is the Abe Vigoda of the rabbinate. Okay. No, in that rumors of his death were premature. In the Jewish newspapers of 1848, it said that Adolf Jelinek was killed in the riots by the reactionary forces of the government. But in fact, that wasn't true. He died in 1893. But, so, just as a little aside. So, Jelinek was not so personally religious. There were accusations against him that in his personal religiosity left a lot to be desired. But, he was an excellent sermonizer. He was a scholar of the Midrash. Many of the collections of the later Midrashim that exist today were produced by him in the 19th century. He would go on to become one of the professors at the Vienna Beit Midrash LaRabbanim, the theological seminary in Vienna, which was an important place. Along the lines of the school in Breslau, led by Frankl. So later in Vienna, you had Adolf Jelinek, Meir Ish Shalom, great scholars of the Wissenschaft des Judentum of rabbinic literature.
Say that he did the Midrash. That was like what what's his name? Kaplan did at the seminary in his early years. He also taught.
But Kaplan was nothing of a scholar compared to Jelinek. Forbid to anyone. Yeah. Okay. Jelinek wanted an organ, no chalitza, no reading of the ketubah at weddings, and no mikvah for a conversion. For a female convert. Now that's a big change. That's a dramatic anti-halachic change. It goes to show you the kind of character that he was. But still, that was considered moderate reform, not radical reform. Yet, the decision ultimately was not to introduce the organ in the synagogues of Vienna. In 1872, there was a compromise that the organ would be postponed indefinitely, and the non-traditionalists, what they got in the compromise was that prayers for the restoration of Korbanot would be recited silently, so that if you didn't want to say them, no one knew the difference. That the Chazan wouldn't say it out loud, it would be done quietly. Okay. Just as the left side of the aisle had to be placated by the hiring of Jelinek, so when Mannheimer died, the right side of the aisle was placated by the hiring of Moritz Gudermann, who was a conservative. And so there's this delicate balance in Vienna, making sure each side gets a little bit of something. Gudermann would function together with two legitimately orthodox rabbis on the Beis Din. They weren't so happy to work with him, but they did it. Vienna was a rare example of orthodox and non-orthodox cooperation in one kehillah. It was small enough that they could accomplish that in the 19th century, even into the late 19th century. The great accomplishment of the Vienna community, aside from on its own turf, was that it created a style, a minhag, a rite, that was fairly traditional, that could take on all over Central Europe. And so all throughout Bohemia and Moravia, the Czech and Slovak lands, Orthodoxy basically died. And what was left? Not radical reform, and not hyper-Orthodoxy, but this middle-of-the-road way of davening, the Vienna Rite, the Minhag Vienna.
Slovakia? I'm not so sure about Slovakia.
Not further to the east. No, not Slovakia, but in Bohemia and Moravia.
Yes, I agree.
Slovakia was more influenced by the Hungarians, and if you go further east to the Carpathian Mountains, it's a whole other...
Yeah,
that's separate area. So, but Bohemia and Moravia and the crown lands of Austria... This Vienna Rite was very popular. What about Prague? So in the 18th century, Prague had an organ. and had cymbals and various other musical instruments on Friday afternoon, up through Lechadodi, stopping just before Shabbos. In 1820, you have the emergence of the Association for the Improvement of Jewish Worship, which is what it sounds like. They're not happy with Jewish worship. They want it to change in the direction of progressive reforms. Rabbi Samuel Landau, who was the son of Yecheskel Landau, the Noda B'Yehuda, was the chief rabbi of Prague. He was a hyper-traditionalist, and he wouldn't budge. In 1835, finally, the reformist camp was able to get a hold of a synagogue building, and Zacharia Frankel, the native son of Prague, was invited to give the inaugural speech. Who did they hire to be their leader? So they hired Leopold Zuntz, the great scholar, who had been previously a preacher in Berlin. But why did Leopold Zuntz leave Berlin a decade and a half earlier? Because he didn't like dealing with the rich Jews, the rich laity, who would boss him around and tell him what to do. He wanted to be his own man. Number one, he didn't want to be subservient to the official rabbis, the Orthodox rabbis. And number two, he didn't want to be subservient to a board of trustees who were the moneyed elite, who were not scholars of Judaism, and didn't know what they wanted. So because he was being pushed and pulled in different directions, he didn't last long in Berlin, and he didn't last long in Prague. He left after 9 months, having given four drushes and writing some bylaws. He was replaced by Michael Sachs, who would go on to become the rabbi in Berlin. And Sachs got along well with the chief rabbi, who by 1840 was Shlomo Yehuda Rappaport, Shear, who was himself a Moskal, about whom we spoke last week. So in Prague, it was not a united community like it was in Vienna. It was too big. It was much larger of a community than it was in Vienna. So you had this lack of unity. But through the 1840s and 1850s, the official community and the reformist element were not that far apart and were not at each other's throats. And the Prague style of moderate reform was basically along the same lines as the Vienna ritual.
But when we say not too far, in the old days could have been they were skila possibly.
No. The machlokes in these Central European cities was nowhere near the vitriol of what we saw in Berlin, in Hamburg, we're going to see in Frankfurt with Hirsch versus the others, or as we'll see tonight in London, where they put people in cheirem and wouldn't bury dead bodies. Okay, it can get really ugly. Vienna was not the case. Prague, even with the disunity, was not the case.
Small communities, as long as it was unified, I guess they didn't care.
Sometimes it's not even the size. It's just an issue of what kind of reform is being implemented, and if it's not an extreme in character, it's close to the tradition, why make a big fuss? Yeah?
So we've really focused on the preachers and the scholars.
Right.
But these changes, whether they were moderate or more extreme,
yeah,
did they energize the masses?
Ah, that's the very next line I was about to say. So the answer to that is the non-Orthodox, moderate, middle-of-the-road style of religion in the Habsburg Empire, in the cities of Vienna and Prague, and especially in Bohemia Moravia, did little or nothing to energize the religious sentiment of non-Orthodox Jews. So the scholars of the movement, like, for example, Michael Meyer, who wrote the official history of the Reform Movement, says, well, the reason that's the case is because they didn't focus on education of the youth. I would argue it's simply because it never worked. In other words, there almost was never a way for the heterodox style of religion to energize those who had already moved far beyond traditional observance. Maybe in the very beginning, in Hamburg and in Berlin, people who were on the verge of apostasy started going to services in the decorous temples for a few years or a generation. But other than that, we never find it to be the case in Europe. America is another story altogether. In America, you do have that. However, in Europe, no.
You have it that they energized in America?
Rare examples, yeah. But when we discuss American Judaism, we'll see that
there's such a thing as a Fabrenta reforma.
You have situations where people who were distant from religious life could become a lot closer by affiliation with a heterodox house of worship that really brings them back up several rungs on the ladder.
There was Huh? They split apart into different forms.
What's that?
The reform. They became Reconstruction.
Well, wait. We'll talk about that in America soon enough. Okay. So, let's turn to Galicia. What kind of Jews live in Galicia? So, traditional Jews, Polish Jewry, southern Poland. Hasidus is very strong in Galicia in the 19th century. What's the big machloket in Galicia in the 19th century? The Hasidim versus the Maskilim. Okay, if in other parts of Eastern Europe it's Hasidim versus Misnagdim, in Galicia it was Hasidim versus Maskilim. The enlightened versus the superstitious, as we might call them. So, what was there any move towards religious reform among the Maskilim of Galicia? The answer is yes. Especially in Lemberg, there was a German-Jewish house of worship. That when we say German-Jewish, but this is Galicia, this is not Germany. Well, the answer is, if you're a Maskil, what language do you speak? What's the cool language if you're an educated person? German. I mean, maybe in Hungary you'll speak Magyar by the middle to late 19th century, you know, if you live in Budapest. But other than that, if you're living in East or East Central Europe and you want to be educated and perceived as an enlightened Jew, you're going to speak German. Later on, there'd also be those who spoke Russian in St. Petersburg and in Moscow at the end of the 20th century. But now we're talking about, in southern Poland, German. Okay, so they have their own synagogue, and they're against certain things. Remember I said anti-superstition. Maskilim versus Hasidim because of anti-superstition. No, the Hasidim. Okay, so what do they not do? Okay, let's listen to what do they not do? No bowing during Aleinu L'Shabeach on the high holidays. No prostrating on the ground. Why not? It's too oriental. It's too old worldish. So this already borrows from the Central European, the German way. We don't want to look too awkward. Something from a different part of the world. Okay, too Jewish. All right. Next thing is no tashlich. What's wrong with tashlich? So theologically, the idea of casting your sins into the water is problematic, and also just the act of throwing the challah is unseemly. No breaking the glass under the chuppah. Why not? So if this was Central and Western Europe, and we were dealing with anti-Zionist or anti-national Jews, your peoples of the Mosaic faith, who wanted to abolish all forms of the national component of Judaism, I understand no breaking the glass because it's remembering Yerushalayim. But why, for Jews who are nationally Jewish in southern Poland in 1830, why are they against breaking the glass? So it's just, it's too violent, it's too unseemly, it's an indecorous act. Okay? It's like being a Vilde Chaya, and they associate that with their religious opponents.
Isn't a Jewish wedding.
All right, it caught on. What can I tell you? All right. And lastly, no kaporos. What's wrong with kaporos? Everything's wrong with kaporos. All right. Okay. So liturgically, they followed the German and the Vienna and Prague rite, and they hired Abraham Cohn in 1844. I mentioned Abraham Cohn a few lectures ago, as being the only rabbi in Europe to be killed, to be assassinated by a Jew. What happened? So he came along the scene, he opposed Kaporos, he opposed prayers for vengeance like Av HaRachamim, which was a common thing among the moderate reformers. He instituted confirmation. All these things are anathema to the traditionalists in Galicia, but the real reason why he was a danger to them was because the position of chief rabbi of that jurisdiction had been open since 1839, since the death of Yaakov Meshulam Orenstein. And so Cohn's supporters pushed his name to be designated as the chief rabbi. The problem is Cohn wasn't even really a rabbi. He was a guy of limited theological training, and this was an area of great Gedolei Yisrael. We're not talking about the middle of nowhere. This is not the San Francisco where you have Gene Wilder as the rabbi. This is Galicia where there are Gedolim. So to have Cohen made the chief rabbi would have been a shanda. So what happened? The traditionalists hired some poor goldsmith to put arsenic in the guy's soup, and it killed the rabbi and his little son, and badly injured his wife and daughter. This was 1848. No, no. As far as I know, I don't know, but I don't think so. I think,
it,
yeah.
It was all a shame, Shemayim.
Yeah.
With God on our side.
Okay.
Did that reverberate from the
community? No, it's a dead issue, yeah. It's a dead, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Well, now, who was responsible?
A Jew.
No, I'm talking about that's a direct, I mean, the who gave the
orders? It's unclear who gave the orders. It's unclear. But presumably he didn't act on his own. He was paid.
Did they catch him and lock him up?
I don't know what the end was, how they exposed all the details, but there's no dispute that it was this Jew who did it, and it was under orders from higher ranking traditionalists. Okay.
There was no reckoning for this whatsoever, whether it be history or in the judicial.
So judicial, there may have been, but in the history books, it's a little footnote. It didn't make a roshim, an impact on interdenominational relations within Judaism. Let's put it that way. Okay. So, what about in Hungary? Reform in Hungary goes back to Aaron Koriner, who had been the rabbinic supporter of the changes done in the Hamburg Temple. But he was the rabbi in Arad, and he was an outlier. Nobody else among the great rabbis of Hungary supported the progressive measures in the German synagogues. So he was on his own, basically. But there's a growing constituency for non-Orthodox style services. So in the 1820s, the moderate reformers in Hungary looked to Vienna as their model. And in Pest, in 1827, they hired the traditional rabbi Loeb Schwab, who is actually going to give drushes in the traditional shul, the mainstream shul, in Yiddish, and then gives German language sermons in the not-so-traditional shul. So he was the communal rav who satisfied both constituencies.
What year?
Late 1820s. So the following items became very popular among the progressive elements within Hungarian Jewry. The vernacular sermon, which in the beginning was German but later would switch to Magyar. The pulpit near the ark. That was a big one. Oh, it's a big one. And the ultra-Orthodox would breathe fire against it and call it a horrible innovation. So whereas the tradition has it that the amud is in the middle of the room, so now the amud is going to be brought all the way to the front and possibly face the crowd and not face forward. Also, you have a speaker's lectern at the front, which allows for weekly sermons.
We discussed it before. Was it like the French, where it was like a staircase
leading up to the top? So in some of the very distinguished synagogues, Dohani, you have that, where it's pretty high up. Yeah.
Yeah, but that's, by the way, taken from the church directly.
Oh yeah, sure, absolutely. Okay, choral music, and that's influenced by the Muslim preachers who go up the staircase to give their speech on Friday. Another thing that was important in Hungary was weddings inside the synagogue. Why, of all things, that should be important, I really couldn't tell you. But
church weddings.
I guess it's an imitation of the church weddings. But of all the countries where this was a controversial point, in Hungary, this was an area of dispute.
And this is the Chassam Sofer afterward.
The Chassam Sofer opposed it, and then later his intellectual heirs at the Pesach Din of Michalowicz, which we'll speak about more in a few weeks' time, banned it together with a few other things that are really only slightly problematic, or not even problematic at all, but they declared if you go to a shul that does these things, it's like going into a house of idolatry.
So there's funerals in the shul.
That they don't discuss. It's a separate matter because there's legitimacy for funerals in shul for a Gadol Yisroel. Talmidei Chachamim, yeah. Okay. Because a synagogue is a place to pray to God, and a wedding, although we might think of it now as a religious occasion, it really isn't a religious occasion. It's a mundane matter of a man betrothing a woman. And so it's wrong to invade the house of God for something as secular as a wedding.
How about a bris?
That's a different story. A bris is a mitzvah.
But yeah. It came up yesterday in the show with Rabbi Billet,
uh-huh,
that in the time of the Gemara, there are references to Kedushin taking place in front of an Aron Kodesh.
That's true, yeah.
So it switched to the other side.
It may be a religious service, but it's not prayer to God. It's a human interaction, and so therefore the argument is that it shouldn't take place in a synagogue. Also, there's a preference for it to be tachas kippas ha-shamayim, underneath the sky. So that's why in some shuls the aron has a skylight. So if you're gonna have the chuppah right in front of the aron, it's underneath the sky. Like in the Great Neck Synagogue, they have that. Okay, so
where do they have weddings?
Outdoors?
Outdoors,
yeah. In the cold, in the Rehova Shel Ir, they would do it. Okay, so in 1846, a modern shul is established in Buda, across the river from Pesk, under the leadership of Ignaz Einhorn. Ignaz Einhorn is a real radical, and will go down as one of the deniers of traditional Judaism. I'll use a kind word. I could say a lot worse about him. So, in 1848, the radicals established the Central Association of Hungarian Israelites. Notice Israelites, not Jews. Israelites is a term you use when you want to conceal the fact that you're a Jew. Except it's not really concealing all that much. They were radicals. They hired Einhorn, and Einhorn declared himself to be a disciple of Samuel Holdheim. Now, Holdheim was the most extreme of the reform of Germany, so Einhorn is going to be the most extreme in Hungary.
Einhorn is no relation to David.
No, but David Einhorn takes over for Ignaz when Ignaz gets fired. So Einhorn is replaced by Einhorn. But they weren't related. They were not related. Okay, so the 1848 revolution built up the hopes of Hungarian Jews that they would be fully emancipated finally. It turned out to be a false hope because the revolution was suppressed, but also because the Magyar leader, Louis Kossuth, he said that in order for Jews to be deserving of Hungarian citizenship, they shall be forced to undergo extreme religious reformation, whether they like it or not. Now, plenty of reform theologians within Judaism favored dramatic reforms. Okay, that was their calling in life. But now they're forced to do it. On our terms, not on your terms. So therefore, the association rejected Kutsuth's demands, saying that it would belittle them and they wouldn't be deserving of the name Jew if they compromised their religiosity for a bundle of goods, for promises of emancipation. Now, what about Einhorn? What did he think should remain in Judaism? He said only the notion of a providential God and the principle of morality are eternally valid. Everything else is up for grabs. That's pretty much everything. Okay, so Einhorn said something very interesting. He said, Zechariah Frankel was right. Religion, Judaism, does arrogate to the people a great measure of authority in determining what content within religion should remain valid in the here and now. Except that whereas Frankel assumed a traditional audience, Ignaz Einhorn assumed a radically acculturated audience that was Jewish basically in name only and was observing nothing. So therefore, what is Judaism?
Nothing.
Okay, yeah.
But if that is your measure or definition of the Jewish faith, then it is not a worldwide faith. It's
no.
It's very cloistered, like community, very provincial.
It's the religion of those people that like that kind of religion there and then. It's not something that's necessarily going to be perpetuated long-term or that logically could sustain itself long-term or that will necessarily appeal to people on the far side of the earth. But for those people in that moment, that's what they wanted. That was their belief.
But if Kossuth says you have to have reformation.
Yes.
That reformation would have to apply to Orthodox?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Which is why it never came to pass. Kossuth's demands were irrelevant in the long term. The Hungarians would not win that revolution. They would gain a great degree of autonomy in 1867, when they'd still be under the Habsburg monarch, who would be the king of Hungary, but no longer the emperor of an Austro-Hungarian empire. He'd be the emperor of Austria and the king of Hungary, but with an autonomous Hungarian legislature. Okay, so what kind of religion did they have in this association in Budapest? Well, they had their Sunday services and not much else. Ignaz Einhorn was expelled after the failure of the revolution. He was replaced by David Einhorn, and in 1852 the association was shut down. The message was clear, that Jews are expected to return to their ancestral traditions and not pursue an agenda of religious reform, and so nothing would then happen for the next decade and a half until 1867, with the change in political circumstance and the emergence of a Jewish National Congress convened by the Hungarian authorities, by the Minister of Religion, Joseph Ötvös, which would result in the irreparable fissure of Hungarian Jewry between Orthodox, Neologue, and eventually status quo. But we will wait for about a month from now. We'll discuss that at length. It's a sad story. One of the saddest stories in the history of European Judaism is Hakera Shalonit Acha, the rip that was never sewn back together. Jacob Katz wrote the book on the Jewish Congress of 1868. A very sad story. Something that didn't happen in a lot of the other communities where they didn't have this fissure. But in Hungary, everybody was a firebrand, especially among the ultra-Orthodox. There was no choice but for this kind of division. Two major sections and a third group that wasn't really a group. It was just everybody who didn't fit into the other two. Status quo. Yeah. Wasn't exactly the most exotic term, but yes. Although there was a range of very traditional Neologue to not so religious Neologue, but basically like 20th century conservative Judaism. Okay, but what about in Russia? So in Russia, the Reform movement found a measure of success in Odessa, Riga, Vilna, and Warsaw. But basically, it was a fringe phenomenon. Even in these towns, there was maybe one synagogue that introduced liturgical reforms. The real issue in Russia in the 19th century was the division between genuine rabbis and crown rabbis. So the Romanov dynasty, the Tsarist regime, tried to infiltrate the Jewish religion by demanding that all the major kihilot have a crown rabbi, which was a paid state official who was ostensibly a rabbi, but sometimes not even a real rabbi, and certainly did not have the respect of the people. The people had their own rabbonim, who were great Gedolei Yisrael, and the crown rabbis were often charlatans, usually graduates of one of the seminaries either in Vilna or Zhytomyr, which were run by the government. The government got Max Lilienthal, a German rabbi, to set up these institutions, bamboozling him, telling him, oh, we're trying to improve the situation of the Jewish religion in Russia. Really, they were trying to destroy Judaism in Russia, and there were conversionary motives. And Lilienthal was told by the indigenous Jewish community, don't cooperate, don't be a collaborator. And eventually he realized that he was fooled, and they ran him out of town. And he came to America, to New York, and then to Cincinnati, and it becomes an important figure in American Jewish history. But in the 1840s, he was the collaborator with the sinister scheme of the Russian authorities in the direction of religious reform. The reason why reform never caught on in Eastern Europe is because traditional Judaism was just too strong, and there was no way for it to compete. But that doesn't mean people didn't walk away from religion. Plenty of Jews in the big cities, even in the shtetls. Okay, by the end of the 20th century, we're no longer Orthodox believing or practicing Jews. All right, they moved in the direction of secularization. But whereas the Western Haskalah led to, oftentimes, Reform Judaism, the Eastern Haskalah did not really lead to a reform-style Judaism. The Eastern Haskalah went past religion altogether and had a different agenda. It was a totally secular agenda. The greatest exponent of the Eastern European Haskalah was Yehuda Leib Gordon, and he wanted there to be a reformation of Talmudic Judaism, make Yahadut, make the Torah compatible with modern life. But the Rabbonim weren't interested in listening to Yehuda Leib Gordon, who was a renegade yeshiva boy. All right, it never happened. Never happened.
But weren't the social and academic and business opportunities in Russia and Eastern Europe still much more limited to Jews than in Central and Western Europe?
Absolutely.
So the temptation was not there.
Okay, so the most important thing is that the move away from traditional religion in the direction of a reform is typically to copy what the Gentile neighbors are doing. If the Gentile neighbors are seen as having a culture which is superior, then Jews are excited about co-opting it. If the Gentiles, who are your neighbors, are seen as being lower than dregs of the earth, then you're not interested in copying their religious ways, you're not interested in copying them at all. You can just mock them. And that was the nature of Eastern European life. The Jews were spit upon by the heathens, but then the Jews looked back upon the heathens as being low class. So there was nothing to copy. It was just mutual dislike. Mutual dislike. All right. What about in Italy? Was there religious reform in Italy? Well, as a denominational matter, there never was reform in Italy. Why? First of all, the Jews spoke Italian. Fluent Italian. There was no other language for the Jews by the 19th century. And they were culturally integrated. Now this is despite the fact that in most parts of Italy, the Jews were not full citizens. In the Papal States, they were persecuted. It wasn't until the unification of Italy that all the Jews of the peninsula are emancipated. But despite the ghetto existence, and despite the inferior legal status, still the Jews were culturally Italian. And so there's no need to tinker with religion as a means of getting closer to Gentile society. They're already in Gentile society.
Weren't they also somewhat Sephardic? A lot of Sephardim?
Well, there were a lot of Sephardim, but there's also just the special Italian rite,
yeah,
which is its own kihila, own
Nusach,
style.
Nusach
Rome. Yeah.
In Jerusalem, you have the Italian synagogue.
Yes.
It is really like leaving Israel for a few hours.
And going to Italy, yeah. So the vernacular sermon, which was a big deal in Germany, already existed in Italy, okay? And the decorous service, which was a new phenomenon in Germany, already existed in Italy. What else do you need? Not much else. Okay, what about the rabbis? So the first modern rabbinical seminary was in Italy, at Padua, in 1829, and there was little need for any further reforms. You have the sermon, you have the nice service, linguistic acculturation is already an accomplished fact, political emancipation will happen whenever it happens, irrespective of religious changes. So the 19th century Italian Jews were not especially religious. Their leading intellectual was Shadal Luzzatto, Shmuel David Luzzatto, and he was an enlightened representative of the status quo. But most importantly, what religion is there in Italy? Catholicism. It's the lion's den of Catholicism. And so changes in matters of faith are quite foreign to the Italian peninsula. Every religion keeps its Catholic version, its Orthodox version, including Judaism. And there's no need to justify non-observance with the emergence of a new denomination. In other parts of the Jewish world, you have to justify your non-observance, your non-orthodoxy, by creating a non-orthodox denomination. In Italy, there was no perceived need for that. Secularization was taking its toll on Gentiles and Jews alike. Everybody's becoming less religious. But for those who care about religion, they have the old-time religion. The Catholics have their Vatican, and the Jews have their Orthodox synagogue. No.
Right.
No. And that's it. Or nothing.
Today.
Yeah, even today. I might have mentioned this before, that I went to the museum in the great synagogue in Rome, and the guy said, a guy not even wearing a yarmulke, we're Orthodox.
Right.
Not in the sense that I'm especially religious, but like Catholic Protestant, there's Orthodox and Reform. What are we? We're Orthodox. That's our thing.
All the restaurants are strictly kosher.
So the liturgy, though, were there departures from the traditional or anything?
No. In fact, Italian Jewry is very proud of its distinct liturgical rite and has no interest in changing it. They're a small group in a large sea of world Jewry, and they want to and are happy with maintaining what is distinctly theirs. And they don't want to be folded into Sephardic liturgy or Ashkenazic liturgy. They want to have their own Minhag Roma. Okay, what about in France? So, in France, the attitude towards religion generally was lukewarm among Jews. Religion was relegated to the private sphere and was subject to tremendous neglect. The consistorial system, which had been in place since Napoleonic times, was very powerful, and it stifled any independent drive for reform. So if you, no single actor on the French Jewish stage could push hard for reform and hope to be successful against what was a massive structure of the consistory. There were complaints, though. Samuel Cohn was the 19th century's biggest critic of the consistorial Judaism, and he said that the rabbinical seminary, which was basically an old-style yeshiva, was not really a modern theological seminary like Breslau or Berlin. He said it has to move. Where should it move from and where should it move to? It was in Metz. Where is Metz?
It's near the German border.
Near the German border. So it's the Ashkenazic section of French Jewry. It should move from Metz to Paris. Why? Because in Metz, the Alsace region where the Ashkenazim are, that's a very parochial and out-of-the-way place where people don't really know anything other than just primitive religion. Move it to Paris, will there be cosmopolitan influence upon the young rabbinical students? And this way the rabbis will be more enlightened. Because as it was, who became a rabbi in France? Poor boys whose parents didn't think that they could make much in business, okay, sent them to the yeshiva where they did learn no secular education. Not because they were ideologically opposed to secular education, just it wasn't available to them. And even the yeshiva learning wasn't on a high level. It was nothing compared to the German yeshivas, and that's nothing compared to the Eastern European yeshivas. So what did they have? They had Orthodox rabbis who were very weak rabbis. They were not strong theologians who could pursue a reformist agenda, and they weren't even great halachists. They were just synagogue rabbis who could barely get the job done. That's what they had. And these kind of characters are not looking to make dramatic changes. They're just looking to keep whatever exists. Okay.
But the proximity to Germany...
Okay. I'm glad you brought that up. It's the very next point. One of the reasons why French Jewry is not so interested in reform innovations is because, putting Jewish identity aside, do the French like the Germans? No, they fought wars with each other for a billion years. Very bloody wars at that. So even though we're all Jewish, still, the French don't like the Germans. And the idea that French Judaism should have to borrow in any significant way from the intellectual product of German Judaism would be embarrassing to them, and they wouldn't want that. So they consciously avoided, to an extent, whatever was coming out of Germany on sort of national lines. Moreover, French Judaism did not have schismatic groups, and they weren't interested in having them. And they saw what happened in Germany, where Kehillot were torn apart, and people were really at odds with each other, so they don't want that. Better to have a unified group, even if it's not the style of Judaism that's most conducive for surviving into the future, the one that makes you most happy, still, we don't want to have machloket. All right. Nonetheless, the consistory in 1856 did approve some moderate reforms. One was that they tried to merge the Sephardic and Ashkenazic rite to have one sidur for the French kehillah. Another was no vengeful prayers like Avarachamim. Another one was that the organ could be played by a Gentile. Not every synagogue in France did this. Only a few did. But in the 1850s, the consistory made a pretty innovative move that the Gentile could play the organ. And also to reduce the pew team. Now, the one thing that never happened in France, there never was an interest in French language Jewish prayer. Why not? Well, now there are prayer books that are French and Hebrew translation, because like you have English Hebrew translation because people want to know what they're saying in their own language. But why was there no interest in French language prayer? Simply because there's no French mass, French language mass for the Catholics. What was there? There was the Latin mass. So the Goyim have Latin and we have Hebrew. You use a classical language in prayer. You don't use the vernacular. So the Jews follow the Goyim. If the Goyim are using a foreign tongue, the Jews will use their own foreign tongue.
Then you have a large Protestant component in
the Huguenots, but the Huguenots were kicked out after the revocation of the Edict of Nantes in 1685. Well, you have some other dissenters, but it's still a small group. France is a Catholic country.
Most of the people didn't give a hoot about
anything. Right, that's the other factor. Religion is basically on the steep decline in France. And when religion is on a very steep decline...
The only major Catholic country that had a situation where the whole country controlled the church.
Right. So the Jewish equivalent is, I stop going to shul. I don't care anymore. And if you don't care, then you don't need to create an alternative type of denomination. You just let the handful of people who do care continue in their orthodoxy. Okay. Also... The French consistorial synagogues were themselves quite decorous. You know, the great Parisian synagogues with their Moorish architecture, they look very impressive. So if you have an impressive looking synagogue, and there's no need for changing the language of prayer, and people are really not involved in theological thinking, so therefore they don't care about the content of prayer, what's left to do? Those who want to go to shul, go. Those who don't want to go, don't go. And that was the fate of French Judaism. It was not a very strong Judaism. Okay. You know what? Well, I was going to do England tonight, but we'll stop. We'll save England for 2 weeks from now. We'll do the emergence of Reform Judaism in England, which is really not Reform, it's really conservative. And then the emergence of Liberal Judaism, which is really Reform. Okay, but that'll be 2 weeks from today. Next week, we're going to have a special session. The topic will be... the 70th anniversary of the partition plan.